The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So first of all, I'd like to congratulate our three new lay ministers. Wasn't that a treat? And to thank Reverend Master Mayon for inviting me to make an offering of the Dharma. And I must say, the Avatamsaka is a hard act to follow. It kind of says it all. And I thought, well, I could sit here and kind of explicate some of it for you, but we don't have 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 months or 4 years, so I'm going to just talk a little bit about some things that have come up for me related to it, and also some current things that are going on and how my practice has helped me in thinking about them. And so Reverend Helen was asking me what the title of this talk was going to be. And I thought, well, it could be Non-Resolutions for Any Year. It could be Letting Go in This Very Moment. It could be Celebrating Darkness and Light. Or it could be what I think we'll end up with is Vows and Resolutions. And part of that came from I realized that December 21st for us is the winter solstice. So happy winter solstice for all of you pagans, that all of us pagans that celebrate the winter solstice. But actually, the winter solstice is not yet. It's not until 3 p.m. and 3 minutes after 3 p.m. I looked it up. So 3:03, you can all roar out into the streets and dance. And here's the interesting thing. I've always thought of it as the winter solstice, but it's only the winter solstice if you're in the northern hemisphere. So if you're in the southern hemisphere, it's the summer solstice. And instead of being the longest day of the year, it's the shortest day of the year. And I thought, well, how's that for things not always being what we think they are? You know, it's a saying that's oft-quoted, that is often quoted from Roshi Shunryu Suzuki, and he would say, not always so. Things are not always what they seem. And I thought, gee, all this time, I thought it was the winter solstice, and here it is, both the winter and the summer solstice. But in looking it up, I also found some interesting things that in prehistoric times, there was feasting, there were purification, bathing, and there was forgiveness. In Poland, in prehistoric times, there forgiveness was a big part of the ceremonies that they did. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? Because in the darkest of times, you know, I can think of it as kind of shrugging off darkness and welcoming the light. And there is this ceremony of forgiveness. And for me, as I'm sure for any of us, all of us, any of us, most of us that listen to any of the news, it's pretty dark out there. At least it has been for me. You know, I try to listen to the weather every day. And so I turn on NPR and listen to a little bit of news. And, you know, you listen to the news from Ferguson, Missouri, and Staten Island, and Milwaukee, and Cleveland, and then the other day, what, 1 or 2 days ago, was it 143 people were killed at a school in Pakistan, most of them children, most of them school children. And you sit there, and you're, it rends your heart. You really get heartsick. You really feel, what is this world coming to? And that's a question, that it's a very good question for Buddhists to ask. What is this world coming to? Because really what we're asking ourselves is, what is my world coming to? What is my world of Buddhist practice coming to? And in the midst of all the misery and grief and heartbreak, I was really encouraged by something else I heard, which was that the parents of Michael Brown, who was the young man killed and shot in Ferguson, Missouri, and the mother of Ty Gurley, who was another young black unarmed man shot in Brooklyn, and the father of Eric Garner, who was the unarmed black man shot in Staten Island, that all of them, in quoted reports in the press, said, and I'm just combining what was said by all of these people, said, let there be peace. Let there not be violence as a result of this. Let there be peace. And one of them, and I don't remember which one, said, I think it was Ty Gurley's mother, said, I want something good to come out of this. I want something good to come out of here. And I thought, you know, if those parents can look at that devastation and that tragedy with that kind of purity of heart and goodness and compassion, then surely I, as a Buddhist practitioner, can look at my grief and despair and say, there's good that's going to come out of this, and how can I contribute to that? And so I think it's the question of how can we contribute to it that brought me to the idea of maybe not resolutions, maybe not New Year's resolutions, because they're quite full of expectation and judgment. What if, instead of resolutions, we substituted vows? We took vows at New Year. We made vows for ourselves. And then I thought, well, you know, that's kind of a no-brainer, because we've already made this wonderful vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. So I think that's enough to work on for the year. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. And one of the teachings, one of the many teachings that comes to me from the Avatamsaka Sutra is making the Buddha's truth one for ourselves, asking the questions and being willing to accept the answer, and then being willing to change ourselves in accordance with that answer. Now, Buddhism has, for me anyway, a history of vows. There's the vow that we all made this morning, whether you actually thought about the fact that you were taking that vow or not, but you made it anyway. We've got your name. We know where you live. We know you made that vow. You know, there's the bodhisattva vows that we recite twice a month. However innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. However infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it. There are also the 10 great vows of the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra, which come from the Avatamsaka Sutra. So vows are not new to Buddhism. And I think of vows as offerings. They're promises that we make to ourselves. And it's an interior thing. And the question then for me would be, how do we translate our vows into our daily life? And how do we translate our vows into our practice? Well, I think for starters, take out your pencil and a piece of paper. Now, you could take out your iPod or your computer if you want to, but actually for something like this, it's better done at a slightly slower pace. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, take out your pen and paper, and start a checklist. And the question that you would ask yourself is, what is my Buddhist practice? You know, I go to the abbey and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is my Buddhist practice? And then start writing. Just start writing what your Buddhist practice is. And chances are you're going to come up with things like, well, meditation and mindfulness and keeping the precepts. Wonderful. And then you say, well, what does that mean? And then you get down into some specifics. And then you go from the specifics to the details. So that you end up with a wonderful checklist that then, starting now for practice, but actually starting on January 1st, you can look at each day in the morning and say, what is it I need to do today to implement my Buddhist practice? And then at night, you can look at it and say, well, I probably didn't get all of it done, but I got that done. And here's an example of what I mean. When I was thinking about mindfulness, which is something that I really need to work on, and I thought, okay, mindfulness sounds good, Scholastica, what do you need to be mindful of? And I thought, well, I need to be mindful of my speech, because way, 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 way back as a layperson, even before I took the precepts, I thought, I'm not sure I'm going to get past, I was thinking of it as getting past them, but now I think about transforming the precepts on do not be proud of yourself and devalue others. Do not speak against others. Do not be angry, because my anger always came out in very unmonastic language, un-Buddhist language. And so I thought, well, okay, how could I narrow that down to something that I could actually work on? And I thought, well, when I'm in a hurry, and when I'm impatient, I tend to be a little short and snippy with people, to put it mildly. And it may be that shortness and snippiness has its place, but as a monk, it feels darned uncomfortable. And I thought, well, okay, so I'm going to pay attention to my language, and what else can I do? And what I came up with was, when I recognize, because a lot of this has to do with being aware and recognizing what we're doing, or what we're about to do, that's an even better one. So I thought, okay, when I know I'm grumpy and I'm irritable and I'm in a hurry and I'm impatient and someone says something to me, what can I do before I answer? And I thought, well, I could put my hands in gassho and I could say the three homages and I could also say, thank you for asking. Thank you for asking. And yes, I'd love to do that. Or thank you for asking. And no, I'm sorry I can't do that. Or, oh, thank you for asking. It's over there. Just enough to give me a little breathing space and to let me recognize that the person in front of me is a Buddha. And do I really want to be snippy with a Buddha? No, I don't. I have no problem answering that. I don't. Do I want to be short with a Buddha? No. I want to be as courteous as I can, and I also want to be respectful. And so that's one example of what I mean when I say, take out your pencil, take out your paper, sit down when you don't have distractions, and start writing out what your practice is. So what would help us to get through that checklist? What would help us to affirm our vows? Well, I think recognizing that all of us sitting here are already Buddha. And if I were out there and someone else were here and said that, I said, oh, no way. No way. But look at the teaching that tells us that. You know, not too long ago, one of the monks giving a Dharma talk here on a Sunday talked about everyday mind is the way. And other ways I've heard that is this very mind is Buddha. When we had a visiting monk from Korea, Sun Moon, and I showed her the Nyoi that's over in the Hotei house that was Reverend Master Ji used, and it has everyday mind is the way on it. And she said, oh, we would translate that every day our mind is the Buddha. And another way that she would translate it is everywhere is the Buddha. So those are some of my adding to my translations of everyday mind is the way. And I thought, well, you don't have to take my word for it, because here's a lovely poem which I think has been used before during a New Year's celebration by Wei Ning, and it says, deluded, a Buddha is a sentient being. Awakened, a sentient being is a Buddha. Ignorant, a Buddha is a sentient being. But with wisdom, a sentient being is a Buddha. If the mind is warped, a Buddha is a sentient being. If the mind is impartial, a sentient being is a Buddha. When once a warped mind is produced, Buddha is concealed within the sentient being. If for one instant of thought we become impartial, then sentient beings are themselves Buddha. In our mind itself, a Buddha exists. Our own Buddha is the true Buddha. If we do not have in ourselves the Buddha mind, then where are we to seek Buddha? So that's part of, we already have everything we need, and the Buddha mind dwells within. And when we make vows to help us make our practice a living thing, then we're making the Buddha's truth one for ourselves. So that's the first of ways that seem to me would help us to affirm our vows, very basic teaching. I think the other basic teaching that I find the most helpful all these years is Reverend Master Jiyu saying, do the best you can. And when I was up in Portland, having the privilege of filling in for Master Mako up there, I wanted to talk about do the best you can, and I thought, I know I've heard her say that, but where is it? Well, where it is, if you want to look it up, is in Roar of the Tigress, Volume 1, and it's on page 122, and this is what she says. Just doing the very best you can changes all things, and that is really all you are asked to do. But have you ever thought what a huge thing to do the very best you can is? It's colossal. I can remember being in the Far East and complaining bitterly to my master, the Archbishop of Tokyo, Kato Chisan, whose secretary I was at the time, that I couldn't begin to do what he wanted me to do because of all the difficulties that people were throwing in the way. And he kept saying to me, all I ask is that you do the very best you can. And one day I realized what he was saying to me, which was, do the very best you can. When I heard the words he was actually saying, which was to do the best you can, then it worked. And within about 2 months, I discovered I'd got about 400 people in his foreign section, which made him very happy. She was the foreign guest master at the time, if I have that straight. But I had to find out for myself what he was asking me to do. And above all, I had to discover what it was I was trying to do. So remember, you are required to do the best that you can. And that this does or does not have the desired consequences is fine. That this is not what you would necessarily like to do is fine. Nice distinction. Nice distinction. And I serendipitously, if that's the word, came across another teaching on doing the best you can. And it was in a book by Robert Fulghum called What on Earth Have I Done? Which I keep thinking I will pass on, but then I find things in it that I want to read again and I don't. But here's something on Do the Best You Can that was done a little earlier than Reverend Master G.U. This was done in the first century A.D., and it was by the Stoic philosopher Epictetus. I have that right, Reverend Chose? Thank you very much. And this is what he says. This is a translation. Generally speaking, this is first century A.D., generally speaking, we are all doing the best we can. Forgive yourself over and over and over. Try to do better next time. When you know you've done the best you can under the circumstances, you can have a light heart. Well, I don't think he was Buddhist, but I thought that was a very Buddhist teaching. So my third and final recommendation, or things that have helped me, is to remember impermanence. If you look in the mirror once a day, you won't be able to forget impermanence. All conditioned things change, whether we like it or not, and human beings are about as conditioned as it gets. So that means there's hope for all of us. And when I think about change and I think about how hard it is, I think about a poem that I came across a number of years ago. These things just happen. You know, you don't look for them, but they're there. This is a poem by Portia Nelson, who was actually a jazz singer. And it sounds long, an autobiography in 5 chapters. I'm going to read it to you anyway. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. Takes forever to find a way out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I fall in. It's a habit. But my eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. And I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down a different street. So what it means is we can change. It takes a while, and there are some deep holes we're going to find ourselves in and have to climb out of. So I think the thing to do on our checklist is to be able to recognize, you can all write this down for later and then transfer it to your checklist. Recognize when change is needed, and we don't always do that. Recognize when change is needed, and then to work on being willing to make that change. There was a nice quote by Pema Chodron on the 2014 calendar. I think it was in the shop. Anyway, I have it on my wall. It says, "Letting go of the fixed self isn't something we just wish to happen. It's something we predispose ourselves to with every gesture, every word, every deed, every thought. We're either going in the direction of letting go and strengthening that ability, or going in the direction of holding on and reinforcing that fear-based habit. So let go." You know, one of the best things that I have found for letting go is a soft and flexible mind. And it's the best lubricant I know for removing attachment. Unfortunately, it doesn't come bottled or tubed, and we can't go and buy it, but we can develop it, a soft and flexible mind. That's from Reverend Master Jiyu. I think along with recognizing when change is needed and being willing to change is to ask for help. You know, we ask for help every single day in our meditation. We ask for help when we're mindful, and we ask for help when we take refuge. We take refuge in the written Dharma. We take refuge in other Sangha members. We take refuge in monks. Refuge is all around us. All we need to do is be willing to ask. And when I say all we need to do, that's a lot, because some of us didn't learn to ask when we came out of the womb, and we still don't know how to ask, but we're working on it. Don't be misled by other people's view of reality. In other words, the worldly view of reality. We sang two of our Master Daizui's invocations this morning, and the one that's titled "There's One Who Waits," there are two verses, the second and third verse, that really speak to me, because one of the things he says there, there's a world beyond the dream of anger, greed, and fear. When we look at anger, greed, and fear as a dream, non-reality, this is an illusion. I don't have to go along with the greed and the fear and the anger that the world says, this is the way things are, folks. But it's only true that that's what people are doing, and that's what we see. But there's another reality, and the other reality is compassion, love, and wisdom. And that's what our practice is. That's why we're making that checklist. So when we get up in the morning, we can say, gee, you know, greed, anger, and fear are not on my checklist. Well, I won't be able to indulge those today. You know, I'll have to look elsewhere. What else does he say? He says there's a love beyond the dream of lust to grab and hold. So we're back to letting go. We're so used to grabbing things and holding on. It's interesting because coming into monastic life, and I can only speak for myself, it seemed to me that the big thing I needed to let go of was, now this is many years ago, so this dates me, was my collection of LP jazz records, my books, my clothes, my little sports car, you know, and all of these things that I had to let go of. And for better or worse, obviously for better, I came to the monastery and found out, well, that's nice, Scholastica, you've gotten rid of those things. What about your opinions? What about your criticisms? What about, well, it's not being done the way I'd like it to be done. What about those things? Would they be good things to let go of? Well, of course, the answer is yes, and I'm working on it, thanks to Reverend Master Jiyu and Reverend Master Daizui and Reverend Master Mann and all the monks here. Whether I'll get finished with it before I die, I don't know, but I'm working on it. So I think we need to look at what the reality is. And the reality for us is our Buddhist practice. The last sentence in that third verse is, when we let go of that lust to grab and hold, there's a gentle, soft, good-humored wish all beings to enfold. You know, one of the bodhisattva vows is, however innumerable beings are, I vow to save them all. I find that terminology a little daunting, but the idea of enfolding all beings, you know, to offer merit for all beings, it seems to me is a wonderful vow. And so my final story to read to you, I don't have to, is again from Robert Fulghum's book, What on Earth Have I Done? And it's a chapter that he calls The Meaning of Life. He is a ordained Unitarian Universalist minister, as well as poet, writer, bon vivant, world traveler, father, husband, etc., etc. Had been living in Seattle. He's got two or three books out. I think the first one was Everything I Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. So it was the title that attracted me to that. And when he wrote this, he was residing on the island of Crete. And this is the story. Are there any questions? A standard offer at the end of lectures and long meetings. And the ritual gesture is meant to indicate openness on the part of the speaker. But in fact, if you ask a question, both the speaker and the audience will probably give you drop-dead looks. Still, there always seems to be some earnest dimwit who has a question. And the speaker usually answers, repeating most of what he already said. When there actually is some time left and there is silence in response to the invitation, are there any questions? Now, this is Robert Fulghum speaking. I often ask the most important question of all. What is the meaning of life? What? Why? Well, you never know. Somebody may have a good answer. And I'd hate to miss it because I was too socially inhibited to ask. Once, and only once, I got a serious answer to my question, and an answer that is with me still. And he continues on. First, I must tell you where this happened, because the place has a power of its own. Near the village of Kolombari, on a rocky bay of the island of Crete, stands a Greek Orthodox monastery. Alongside it, on land donated by the monastery, is an institute dedicated to human understanding and peace, with a special mission to achieve rapprochement between Germans and Cretans. It's an improbable task, given the bitter residue of World War II. This site is important because it overlooks a small airstrip at Malamé across the bay, where Nazi paratroopers invaded Crete. During the invasion, they were attacked by ordinary Cretans with antique guns, kitchen knives, pitchforks, and hay scythes. The German retribution was terrible. The populations of whole villages were lined up and shot for assaulting Hitler's finest troops. High above the institute is a memorial with a single cross marking the mass grave of young Greek men killed in the fight around the monastery. In all the surrounding villages, there are graves of those men and women and children who died fighting the Germans. Not soldiers, citizens. Every village square has its monument to those who died. And across the bay, on the hill above the airstrip, is the regimented burial ground of the Nazi paratroopers. The memorials are so placed that all might see and never forget. Hate was the only weapon the Cretans had at the end, and it was a weapon many vowed never to give up. Never, ever. Against this heavy curtain of history, in this place where the stone of hatred is hard and thick, the existence of an institute devoted to healing the wounds of war is a fragile paradox. The Orthodox Academy of Crete. How has it come to be here? The answer is a man, Alexander Papaderos. He is a doctor of philosophy, teacher, politician, citizen of the world, but a son of this soil. And after the war, he went to Germany for his graduate education. He came to believe that the Germans and those on the island of Crete had much to give one another, much to learn from one another. Moreover, they had an example to set. If they could forgive each other and construct a creative relationship, then any people could. To make a fine story short, with the support of the legendary Bishop Irenaeus, Papaderos succeeded, and the Institute became a reality, a conference ground on the site of horror, and it did indeed become a source of productive interaction between the two countries. Books could be written on the dreams that were realized by what people gave to people in this place. And now, from all over the world, groups came to address conflict and to exchange the ideas that bring people together instead of dividing them. Alexander Papaderos, one look at him and you understand. You see his strength and intensity, the vivacity radiating from his person. And to speak to him, to shake his hand, to be in a room with him when he spoke, was to experience his extraordinary humanity. Few men live up to their reputations when you get close. He was an exception. And so at the last session, on the beginning of a two-week, on the last morning of a two-week seminar on Greek culture, he rose from his chair and at the back of the room and walked to the front, where he stood in the bright Greek sunlight of an open window, and he looked out, and he turned, and he made the ritual gesture, "Are there any questions?" And Robert Fulgrim continues, "There was silence. There were no questions." "No questions?" Papaderos swept the room with his eyes. "And so I ask, Dr. Papaderos, what is the meaning of life?" Well, uneasy laughter followed, and people stirred to go. But he held up his hand, and he stilled the room. And he looked at me for a long time, asking with his eyes if I was serious, and seeing from my eyes that, yes, I was. And he said, "I will answer your question." Taking his wallet out of his hip pocket, he fished into a leather billfold and brought out a very small, round mirror, about the size of a quarter. He turned the mirror over in his fingers and began talking in a quiet, reflective voice. "When I was a small child," this is in quotes, "when I was a small child during the war, we were very poor, and we lived in a remote mountain village. And one day on the road, I found the broken pieces of a mirror. A German motorcycle had been wrecked in that place. I tried to find all the pieces of the mirror and put them together, but it was not possible. So I kept only the largest piece, this one. And by scratching it on a stone, I made it round. I began to play with it as a toy and became fascinated by the fact that I could reflect light into dark places where the sun would never shine, in deep holes and crevices and dark closets and behind walls. It became a game for me to get light into the most inaccessible places I could find. I kept the little mirror, and as I went about my growing up, I would take it out in idle moments and continue the challenge of the game. And as I became a man, I grew to understand that this was not just child's play, but a metaphor for what I might do with my life. I came to understand that I'm not the light, I'm not the source of light, but light, the light of truth, understanding, and knowledge is there. And that light will only shine in dark places if I reflect it. I am a fragment of a mirror whose whole design and shape I do not know. Nevertheless, with what I have, I can reflect light into the dark places of this world, into the dreary places in the hearts of men and women, and change some things in some people. Perhaps others may see and do likewise. This is what I am about. This is the meaning of my life. End of quote. And Robert Fulghum continues, and then he took his small mirror and, holding it carefully, caught the bright rays of sunlight streaming through the window, and he reflected them onto my face and onto my hands folded on my desk. Much of what I experienced in the way of information about Greek culture and history that summer is gone from memory. But in the wallet of my mind, I carry a small, round mirror. And I know what I can do with it and what I can do with me. So I think that all of us can take the light that we have, the light that has been given to us by the Buddha Dharma, and we can reflect that light into the world, into the all beings, into the person that we're talking to, the person that we're writing to, the person that we're listening to. You know, when I, at some point in my life, there was a wonderful, is it a gospel tune? I can't remember. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Laurie, we should find that and sing it sometime. This little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. It doesn't matter how little it is. The point is that it's up to us and it's our responsibility to reflect it. So let your light shine and keep on with that checklist every morning. Thank you all for coming. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.